Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for August 2018. I'm your host, Jonathan Buchan, and I'm joined once again by the butter to my popcorn, Tim Nelson.
Oh, man.
That sounds really creepy when you say it out loud.
It is creepy. I like it. I feel like silky, smooth.
Yes, that's what you are, Tim. That's
fatty.
How I think of you.
I'm like saturated fat.
Right.
Yeah.
In a good way.
Right. Like I come out of a gal's nipple. And then I'm churned. Is that what you
far,
mean? John,
far.
Is that what you mean?
I didn't mean that, but I like it. And I am glad that you said that. How's it going?
It's going all right. I don't know where we're going to go from here.
There's nowhere to go from there.
I don't know if Common Sense Media can really...
Oh, my gosh. John Piper is going to tweet at us so hard.
Oh, man.
Hey, you were recently on vacation. Where did you go?
I went to Colorado.
Colorado.
Rocky Mountain National Park.
Heck yeah. That's awesome. What'd you do there?
I drove around while the kids complained about whatever there was to complain about there. It's like idyllic.
Is that the one where you drive up the mountain?
Well, there's a lot of national parks where you drive up mountains.
Okay. In Colorado. I went to one specifically in Colorado.
That would be one where you drive up to the top. There's a pass up there.
Oh,
and it's
so
above
great.
Tree line. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. You've been there. I didn't know you've been there.
Yes. And when it was raining when we were there, and you drive on those mountain passes, and it is scary because you realize that one slight jerk and you're dead.
You're dead.
Yeah. But you didn't die. You're here. And we are glad to have you. You love fly fishing, don't you? Did you get any fly fishing done while you
were there? I got a problem with fly fishing lately. I've kind of got a little obsessed. People in my life are beginning to step in. And,
intervention?
Yeah. They're like, I had somebody tell me who loves fly fishing, you get too much gear recently. But yeah. So I caught a bunch of fish. I caught my first 20-inch rainbow trout. Actually, I caught three of them on the trip.
Is that rare? I don't know anything.
They're
about
huge.
It. Okay.
And then there's this club I didn't quite join, which this is fly fishing stuff. Sorry for
this
people that
great.
Don't give a rip, but I'm like all weird about it right now.
Yeah.
It's called the 2020 Club, and it's if you can catch a 20-inch trout on a size 20 hook, which is like the smallest hook you could barely thread it with a really, really small piece of line.
Yeah.
And it's for folks who have caught a 20-inch trout on a 20. I caught a 20 on an 18.
How many people are in this club? Thousands?
Well, I don't know. It's just kind of like, it's not really a club. I don't
think
there's...
Do you enter your name somewhere?
I don't think there's really a meeting of these folks. I don't think it's real.
The club sounds so exciting.
It's kind of like not actually a club. I think it's more of a thing people say.
It's people say.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you didn't round up. You're like 20 by 18. That's what I did. I'm going
to
get there someday.
I didn't do it, but I'd like to.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of things in Colorado that you can get in, like 14ers. Do you know what that is?
It's no,
14,
absolutely not.
Those are mountains that are over 14,000, so you can do several 14ers. Yeah,
fly
it's
fishing.
Fascinating.
I want you to take me fly fishing sometime because I really want to learn.
I'm not very good yet. I'm learning too. Mm-hmm. So I've caught some fish, but yeah.
One time I went golfing and they were like, "Hey, it's gonna be great. We're gonna teach you and it's gonna be really fun." And then I was so bad I couldn't hit the ball. And then by like the fifth hole, they were like, "Can you just like hold the stuff for just
so they." They say that fly fishing, it's the golf of fishing.
Just as long as you don't turn on me halfway through, that's what I'm worried about.
Well, I can't. Are you going to hook me in the face or
probably.
Something?
Probably.
Yeah, I might turn on you, John.
All right. So in your vacation, have you seen anything lately? What have you been watching?
I saw a moose.
You saw a moose? Yeah, okay.
And some marmots.
Nice.
What have I been watching?
Yeah.
You know what? On vacation, I watched a film by Errol Morris.
Another Errol Morris feature.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was about a woman who took large format Polaroid photos. It's a friend of his that was... Anyway, I forgot the name of it.
Yeah.
Just find it. I think it's on Netflix or it's on Prime. But yeah, so that was really interesting because he was just basically, it's his buddy. And she was talking about what it was like to do large format because the format is one-to-one.
Okay.
And so the image that you see is the image it takes. And then it's super, pretty high res.
So it's just about her life?
Yeah, it was about her life, what she did. She also, I think, Allen Ginsberg was a buddy of hers.
Mm.
So she took a bunch of...
Famous poet, beat poet.
Right, and like poet, activist, blah, 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 whatever. Mm-hmm. And so she had taken a bunch of his stuff. So that's how she got famous. But she was just talking about what it's like to be an artist over time and being a woman. And she, she was in her 70s, I think. And then what it was... When Polaroid, this is kind of the twist that's so cool about it. So basically the format, Polaroid got sold. And then the people that bought Polaroid didn't care about the old film. They were just going to trash it. So they had a group of artists petition to like say, "Hey, sell us the old film stock."
Huh.
If she lost that, she had done all this portraiture it would be gone. Anyway, it's so expensive that she, like, you maybe you're a wealthy New York family, you went to her studio. It's such an expensive setting that she can only use, she'll take two photos for your entire thing, and you get to pick the better one.
That's cool.
It is. And then she kept all the B-sides, and so she goes through them, and it's really cool.
Nice. You texted me the other day. You texted me, and you said, if you want to watch a perfect scene, watch the opening scene of Touch of Evil. And I did watch the opening scene, and it was amazing. This this continuous shot of this bomb in the car, Orson Welles.
Yes.
Super cool scene. I didn't watch the rest of the movie because, you know, it's from the 50s or something. I have better things to do.
58.
But just kidding.
So
I'm kidding.
What's crazy? Yeah. Touch of Evil.
It
what
was
is
really
crazy
good.
About that scene?
Yep.
Because I haven't even watched the whole movie yet because I read a bunch of reviews and they're like, the reviewers who do this for a living were saying that even when you watch that movie the first time, you got to watch it like three more times to understand what happened, which is kind of a failure in some ways.
Yeah, that's.
But I think it's also kind of indicative of that format. It's kind of noir, but it's amazing. Like, so people talk about Citizen Kane all the time, cinematography.
Yeah, I think that's the only one I've seen of his. Yeah.
But the cinematography in this is amazing. And then the sound editing, I was talking to you about how, like, as the couple would walk past
the car, this car is just tracking and you hear it, right. Then people are walking past and
they're doing stuff. Like, I always talk about Lubezki constantly, right? Mm-hmm. They're doing stuff with like huge, super long shots over streets in and out of rooms and like up and down and booms and everything. And they're doing it without any computer aid in 1958. And they're doing all that sound mixing too, where you walk with it, where as the camera moves past the shop, it gets louder because there's music coming out of a store. Yep. And then it fades off as the camera gets farther away. So they're matching all of that.
Yeah.
They're doing it like in a way that's kind of perfectionistic in 58.
It's incredible. It feels ahead of its time. It feels like a Scorsese level.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah,
it
totally
is. And so that's, but it doesn't get that same, like, everyone's Citizen Kane, which I get because Citizen Kane is a story of like desire in some ways and like corruption and all that. So it doesn't get that same level of respect. But like, if you look at just the cinematography and a lot of that as Welles, it's not necessarily just the cinematographer. As Welles is like being a perfectionist.
Yeah.
And he's a genius.
And you said that the studio wanted to ruin that by like putting credits in that opening scene.
I didn't
know
that until I looked it up because you can watch this, like, it's not a director's cut because he was dead before, you know, before he could make those choices. Mm-hmm. But it's according to some of his wishes, like how he might have wanted to have that cut. They were running credits over this scene.
It's unforgivable.
And they wrecked it.
Yeah, totally.
So anyway,
it's wonderful. You can go online on Netflix right now. Just watch the opening 5 minutes to Touch of Evil. It is so worth your time.
It gave me chills, man.
It's wonderful. It really is.
I was like, this is what film's about right here.
That's it. Yep. So do yourself a favor and go do that right now. This spot wouldn't be complete unless I talk about TV and you start to lose it. So I've got to mention.
Oh, gosh.
I have got to mention.
Guys, you're going to mention it. We're sorry. Look at.
I'm not sorry. He's the only one who's sorry.
It should be clear to you guys that we have no self-discipline. Okay? We have no self-discipline whatsoever in this podcast.
Cinema faith. It all falls under the realm. How would you define cinema?
Movies. Film.
Film.
Not TV.
Goes through a lens to make a TV show.
It's not pottery. I can talk about pottery every time. That's art, and it's saying something, and it's got...
It's completely related. I artists. Stand by it. This is my show. Westworld Season 2. Tim. HBO is the best... Seriously, the best premium cable network out there. I love HBO. I was so impressed by Westworld Season 2. I just finished it last weekend. Season 1 was okay. It laid the groundwork. I think I gave it like a B+. But everything goes to 11 in Season 2. It's like they lay the groundwork and Season 2 is the payoff. It's like every philosophical and theological question you've ever had about artificial intelligence is this show. You remember Jason Butler?
Yes.
Our old pastor, Jason Butler, he moved to North Carolina, started a church there.
Yes.
Shout out to Jason if you're listening.
What's up?
He used to have all of these deep worries about AI, that AI was going to like destroy us, you know? And this is what this show like touches on all the questions he brought up. Like, if we ever actually make AI, what rights should they have? How should we treat them? Should we let them access the internet? Just all these questions that you don't think about. That's what Westworld Season 2 is, and I loved every minute of it. Watch it right now. It's so good. There you go. That's it. That's all I got.
Oh, man.
I love it. Anyway, so Tim, a couple nights ago, you and I saw a movie together. And it was wonderful because I don't think we've seen a movie together in quite a while.
It's been a while.
Yeah, we usually see them separately. But this time, you picked me up. We went there. We got butter on our popcorn. And we sat down and we took in a film together. And what was that movie, Tim? You forgot. You literally forgot what we were going to talk about.
Eighth Grade.
Yes. Eighth Grade. And that is our movie discussion for today. Eighth Grade, written and directed by Bo Burnham. Are you ready to talk about this thing?
I think I'm ready to talk about Eighth Grade.
Here we go. Eighth Grade. So, Tim.
Wait a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
What were you like in Eighth Grade, John?
What I was like in Eighth Grade was...
Because we're going to talk about it, right?
And yeah. It was a complete and total dork, man. It was bad. Basically, anything you could do to put a target on your back as an eighth grader, I had it. I had pimples. Bad pimples.
Every eighth grader.
I had to go to a doctor for it. I had Peter Pan haircut. I was short. I had pants.
Wait a sec. What does that mean? What is a Peter Pan haircut?
So it means like split down the middle and then like your hair goes down to your chin.
You're very valiant looking.
Yeah. So bad. Man. Braces, short, pants that didn't quite fit right. The whole package was bad. I was bullied every single day in eighth grade. There was actually probably the worst year of my life, if I had to be honest about it.
Yes.
That's pretty dark, though. It's pretty deep.
Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't want to. No. I just wanted to go there. I don't know. If somebody said that they had a good eighth grade,
yes,
I would freaking stay away from them.
What was it like for you?
Oh, horrifying.
Mm.
It was terrible. See, here's my problem. I was the same size in eighth grade that I am now, but I'm like a kid in my head. I still am a little bit.
Yeah.
And then I would do stuff because I wanted to get attention. And so I did something like I just kept the top of my hair and shaved everything else around there. And I was this big old goofy kid, 6 foot tall in eighth grade and like, you know, 200 pounds and just like not used to my body and like flubbing around everywhere.
But that's the biggest problem is your body's out of control. You feel like an alien in your own skin. Eighth grade's terrible.
It's kind of terrible. And like your hormones are just going insane.
Yes.
I remember you're like in class and your body's like not cooperating.
That's a really nice, delicate way to put it.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying.
And you're like, I gotta stay here for a while. People are like, well, we gotta go.
Book on your lap.
There's another class coming. And I'm like, I gotta stay here for a while. So like, that's horrifying. And then like your whole body is like,
it's terrible, man.
Yeah, it's terrible. Your body like went from like 2 years before you're like, I like G.I. Joes. And now your body's like, I want to have sex.
With everybody, the teachers, the students.
It just doesn't even matter. You're just, your body is like way out of control and you stink.
Yeah.
So, you know, and weird stuff like you sometimes shave, but maybe you need to, but you're not quite sure of these rhythms of life. And then your brain is all developing and you're angry with people all the time. And it's just horrible.
Eighth grade is awful. And someone made a movie about it. And his name is Bo Burnham. Yes. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So as far as plot is concerned with eighth grade, because I'm sure there's some of you who have never heard of this movie, you haven't seen it. I'll give you a little rundown. The plot's very simple. You might even say it doesn't have one. Remember we talked to that lady before we went in? You were like, is this a good movie? She's like, yeah, but like nothing happens. Like, remember? She was all down.
She was like, it's a great performance.
Yeah.
We can talk about it afterwards. And that was weird because I was like, are we really going to talk about
it? Are we going to talk about it? Like, she's going to wait for us. She didn't wait. She wasn't there.
She wasn't going to talk to us about it.
She left.
That was a little weird.
But that's what she said. And I get it because you could say that not much happens because this is really like a slice of life kind of movie. It's a character study of this girl in eighth grade. Her name is Kayla. It is the last year before high school. So she's in that transition period between eighth grade and high school. It's her graduation week. And we just sort of follow Kayla around. She's very socially awkward, like all eighth graders. She's very introverted. She makes these Instagram videos. So that's what's kind of cool is there's this contrast, right? She's like at home. She's making all these kind of how-to Instagram videos about how to be confident, how to, you know, all the stuff that she's struggling to do in actual life. And
so
then,
like if, yeah. Yeah, it's like me if I was like, I'm going to, I have a new series of weight loss videos. you know what I mean? Or I'm going to teach you how to be introverted.
Yeah.
So like, it's just, it's like it's basically aspirational video making, how to be confident, how to be successful in social situations.
Yeah, but she's acting like she's mastered it and she hasn't. And yeah, it's so basically we follow Kayla around. It's her last year. She's going to high school. She's freaked out. She wants friends. She wants a boyfriend. She doesn't know how to get it. She doesn't know. And that's pretty much the movie, right? There isn't some major plot that drives things. We just follow Kayla around.
But she's pretty positive.
Yeah, she is. She is.
She's likable even.
Mm-hmm. Totally. So the movie is written and directed by stand-up comedian named Bo Burnham. It's his first feature film, so his first venture into filmmaking. He actually got a start on YouTube. He became a YouTube sensation by like making these viral songs that were kind of goofy songs, right? And then they went viral and got like millions and millions of hits. And then he ended up turning that into stand-up routines. So he has a couple stand-up routines on Netflix that you can check out. We both watched it. Now, Tim, how would you describe Bo Burnham's stand-up style? What's his vibe?
I hate it. So he's got these bits, but they're like so... I feel like he's incredibly clever, but I don't think he's funny. It's like everything he does... So like a really good stand-up will feel the crowd, work the crowd. I mean, he's a good stand-up, but everything is so... Down to the smallest thing, he's in control. What a good stand-up does is they let the audience have a little bit of control and then they take it back.
Mm.
And then they're kind of like a shepherd, right?
Mm-hmm.
This guy is like completely never gives up any control. He's like totally wanting to be in control of the audience the entire time. And so to me, it felt like tiring.
Yes, I totally agree. He's super talented. I mean, let's admit that. Like, this guy can sing. He plays the piano. He does these full-on musical bits. He's going from thing to thing. But it really is, like, too much. Too much coming at you.
So what I like... So this is interesting, because he's a stand-up. Maybe he should be a director.
Mm-hmm.
And he is. So, because a director should have all those qualities I just said. Total control. Everything should be polished. Yep. Everything should be thought out 50 times. And then executing a vision without any compromise.
Mm-hmm.
That's good from a director. Like, if you're a director, a film director, that's great. From stand-up, he just comes across so tight and so controlling. And so he comes across almost like the character in this film.
Ah.
Which is like the idea of like you're trying so hard and, I hope they like me.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're putting like twice as much effort or whatever. But yeah, it's not, I didn't like the stand up that much.
I didn't love it either. And he actually, suffered from anxiety, which he had to stop doing stand up because he would be paralyzed by anxiety attacks, which I would totally understand. I mean, all these song lyrics from memory and like every single thing planned out, like you said, it's crazy. But yeah. I know what you're saying. It's like, what? Go ahead.
Comedians are just funny.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're funny. This guy doesn't seem to be like a funny guy. He seems like a guy who's writing comedy.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like he's making up funny stuff and he's like grinding his head in a pencil sharpener to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like clever, but you never get the sense that you're allowed to share in the funny.
Yeah. You receive it like that. It's like you see something and you're like, oh, that's funny.
That's clever.
Oh, that's clever.
Oh, all right.
Right, exactly.
I can wrap my mind around exactly why I'm here. I know you paid money. I should be funny. Other than that, don't know why I'm here. To make you laugh, right? That's only half right. Look at the world. I don't know why I'm here. All this laughter can't feed starving Africans. I just hope I don't get more from this than you do. I would love to tell you that everything is fine. You wanna be happy? Well, get in line. Yeah, this is almost musically incoherent at this point. Y'all ain't never seen a comedy show like this in your fucking life. And for good reason, it gets old after a few minutes. You'll see. Let's get this show going. Let's get this show started. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4. So I was at the dentist the other day. Yeah. And nothing funny happened, so I was like, don't mention that on stage.
And I don't want to down his talent, because like you said, he is just like, he lights up the stage, but it's almost like the wrong medium, like you said. You know, a typical stand-up is, hey, there's a mic, and you go out there, and it's just you and the audience, and he's just like sort of doing his own thing, and you happen to be there observing it.
And it's super choreographed. Mm-hmm. It's almost like he's... When you are trying to show how smart you are in your comedy, it can backfire on you.
And he definitely likes poking the bear when it comes to controversial topics, right? Like, he goes head on into racism, white supremacy, LGBTQ, just like goes for it.
But most comedians do.
Right. Right. But
he makes you feel it, though, which is like,
it's, I don't know. It's
the opposite of what comedy should be. Comedy should be like a parable.
Uh-huh.
It should get you, like, it should come around, you know, open the back screen door and be like, ha ha.
That's right.
Got you. And this is like, dink, with like a hammer over the head. And you're just like, okay, all right.
You know, there's kind of a whole genre of comics that like basically saying something that's really offensive, and then they're like, it's just a joke, I'm being ironic, and then they turn around and say another thing that's offensive, and it just gets like kind of tiring. Ricky Gervais is like that in his stand-up, even though I love him in Office and Extras and stuff. But
if you think about like who are the good comedians, like the classically
Jim
good...
Gaffigan, I mean, as far as modern day comedians,
yeah, Gaffigan's good. He's like kind of like, you know, a family friendly observational comic that everyone, like a crowd pleaser. But I even think of like the classic ones, which should be like Eddie Murphy, George Carlin. I mean, they're not clean and they're not safe.
Right, it's fine.
But like a lot of their stuff is like, they're comfortable in some ways. Mm-hmm. Richard Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in their comedy a lot of times will come out of their actual pain. This guy seems like he's wearing a mask the entire time.
Yes.
So like, you know, Richard Pryor, you know, he's like raised in a brothel. And his comedy will come out of that. And it's dark. But it's out of his pain that the comedy's coming from. I don't sense any of that with Bo Burnham.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like this eighth grade movie might be the case.
Well, that's what's interesting is that so he makes this movie. It's his first feature film, and it feels like the exact opposite of his stand-up, which is so crazy to me. I'm actually glad that I watched his stand-up after I saw the movie, because it really made the contrast stand out all the more. Like, in his stand-up, he's really cocky, and he's loud, and he's in your face. And then the movie is subtle, touching, sympathetic, right? Like, it's this the opposite of his shtick. Did you feel that way?
It didn't seem to line up. But right. I also would say that the movie had total, like a lot of good movies, there was total control.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of times a dramatic film will kind of yield itself more to like having total control.
Mm-hmm.
Schindler's List, you better have somebody that has total control over every little part, right? We talk about that film all the time because I know you love
it. That's my favorite film.
Versus like comedy, like you want somebody that's a little bit out of control. Like that, like, will allow you to be, because you got to laugh. You got to get outside yourself a little bit. So I feel like this dramatic film was a lot better and a better fit probably for his personality. Hopefully he makes some more, because it was really good.
I think so too. And he channels an eighth grade girl as his main character. He wrote and directed the movie. So he finds this character within himself, and he actually is a pretty good writer. He is able to tap into this character in a very authentic, sincere way. A lot of that is due to the acting, and we'll get to that shortly. But I was impressed with his writing. As far as his directing, so you mentioned his style as stand-up. Like, how would you describe his directing aesthetic?
It's just run-of-the-mill.
That's exactly how I felt.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty rough around the edges. It's his first film, granted, but there was nothing special in the directing department, and that was kind of a blow for me. I mean, you know, he had some flourishes here and there. There's some songs and that are like, you know, he'll attach a song to a character and some things like that, but it kind of...
I liked some of the music choices. I don't know if he did that or not, but like when they played Come Sail Away when she started going on the internet.
Yeah.
So the idea
scrolling
of
on her phone.
Come sail away. Was that what it was?
Sail away. Yeah.
Holy crud.
Which one were you singing?
Some other one. So there's a lot of those.
Yeah, she's scrolling through her Instagram feed and sail away.
It's so weird how many songs are called This Is It.
Ah.
There's like two or three of them. If you're a listener and you can identify them, we'll give you a free nothing. But you should post something.
I should.
Can you tell us who two songs called This Is It? A little hint, they're from the 80s.
Isn't that the name of the Michael Jackson documentary?
I don't know.
Anyway, directing, a little bit run of the mill, kind of rough around the edges. Yeah, it just didn't... It felt a little empty to me. It felt like a slight notch above a student film. right? There's some scenes that go on a little too long. It's a static shot. You know, think about the dining room table scene with just like Kayla and her dad, right? And he just stays on it. And I just, there were moments that made me feel like back when I was in college, like this.
I kind of like that scene.
Okay.
And I feel like there might have been some reasons why he did that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of scenes like that, like in the backseat of the car.
Mm-hmm.
It just never ends. Like that scene, it's like, and I think that might actually be intentional because this guy, he's super intentional, even in his stand up. He's like making us uncomfortable. We're in this scene and we start feeling uncomfortable because we're used to so many of these shots being like combined so quickly.
Yeah.
Close up, establishing, you know, like, or whatever. You know, film school. I didn't go to film school. You know, going through all of those different shots, like in one little setup, but yeah, he just won. But it makes us uncomfortable. I'm sure he has the ability to do more than that.
I have two minds about it because I totally see what you're saying. There is a point to be made that the dullness, if you will, of the aesthetic actually does increase the empathy that we feel with the characters and the sincerity. It really feels like you're watching this eighth grade girl. But I also feel that it makes the movie feel a little empty. So let's compare it to another film from last year, my favorite film, which is, of course,
what's her name?
Lady Bird.
Lady Bird.
Come on.
I had Saoirse Ronan in my head. Does that count?
Saoirse Ronan. Yeah, totally. So Lady Bird is my favorite film from last year. Greta Gerwig. I think they're very similar in ways because Lady Bird also does not have a plot that drives things. It's just a snapshot of this girl before her transition to college, in this case, rather than high school. But it's very similar, but it's also very different in the fact that the lack of plot is completely compensated by Greta Gerwig's punchy direction, right? She is not a director that lingers on a scene. She gets in and then gets out, right? Her writing is like a punch in the gut at every turn, and that directing fills in all the holes.
I don't know if I agree with all what you just said.
Come on.
There's some lingering. Maybe I'm thinking of Noah Baumbach movies, and it's not Greta Gerwig.
Well, that's her husband. Yeah.
Okay, so let's get it. So we've talked about this before when we talked about Linklater. So we talked about Linklater's obsessed with the idea of boundaries and transitional states. So he does films about somebody that goes to college for the first time and figures out what their identity is.
Mm-hmm.
And he does The Last Day of High School in
Days and Confused,
and it becomes this
Boyhood.
Right.
So, like a whole movie about it.
So there's this idea, and then like I think of John Hughes. You know, Molly Ringwald, I read in a New Yorker article about this film. Did you see this?
I didn't.
She said that this is the best teen movie ever made.
Oh man, I know she tweeted that, and
she tweeted it,
and Bo Burnham retweeted that and said, "I'm basically dead now." You know,
it was the best teen film ever or something.
So
I was like, "Oh my gosh,"
yeah.
So like that, she would say that, you know, Hughes can't speak because he's gone, but this would be like accurate, which I think is pretty cool. But getting to like as far as like the Lady Bird,
yeah.
Lady Bird versus this, what do you think the big differences are? The punch, you say this is a little slobbier.
So you have two films that don't have a plot that's carrying the day, and I think one of them is completely compensated by Gerwig just being in total control of the film and it just moving along with fast, crisp direction. And this one doesn't have that because it just has this sort of dull aesthetic, and so you feel. It feels kind of empty. That's me. That's how I feel.
So when we were talking, I said I didn't feel tension in every scene in Lady Bird, but I felt like in this film I did.
Okay.
Every scene I'm like, is she going to die? Is someone going to rape her?
Right.
Is she going to do the drugs now? I mean, it was like after school special fear in every scene for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, you got to tell your dad. You know, like, or don't go with that stranger. I mean, it was like every after school special. Oh no, do you think that high school girl really likes her? Is she going to let her down? Like, you know, I mean, like every scene had this like social anxiety that was built into every scene. I didn't feel that way. Lady Bird. Lady Bird felt more meandering. It felt like it had tension and then relief of the tension. And then it had quirkiness that kind of made it easier for us to watch. I feel like that eighth grade was a lot harder to watch because it was just tension. And the way I described it when I was, somebody asked me what I thought. I said, it's a horror film about eighth grade. And their response was, well, yeah, because eighth grade is a horror film.
We can all agree on that. Yeah, totally.
And it has that same, I even said like, you know, like you love It Follows.
Yeah,
but like
I did.
Anything that's got suspense or tension. tension that's like really high stakes. Like even like I think about when I watched the original Chainsaw Massacre or death, dismemberment, sexual assault, drugs, suicide. I thought it was going to happen like at any point in that film. Mm-hmm. I felt like you had this fragile human being, an eighth grade girl. And it was like every moment I was like, oh, they're not going to say some horrible body image thing to this girl after they post this photo. Lord have mercy. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they, you know, it's just, they really got that sense. So I don't feel any of that in a John Hughes film. And I don't feel any of that in Lady Bird.
I think that's the other side of the coin. And I can totally see a case for this, is that there is something about the simplistic aesthetic that actually makes it more visceral and more of a knockout. When you mentioned Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I think it's a great example. There was a remake of Texas Chainsaw that was like in 2003. It was very like modern day Texas Chainsaw, just like a modern day take on it. But I ended up watching that first, and then I watched the original from the 70s with my girlfriend in high school. And there is something about that movie that feels dangerous, even though it's more primitive and less flashy. Like literally 20 minutes in, she was like, I don't think we should be watching this. Like, that's,
is that it's hard to watch.
Yeah exactly.
So I think this has that. I also think it doesn't, there's nothing about it, it's so real that it's hard to watch. So I look at Lady Bird and I'm like, oh, it's quirky. And it, and Lady Bird to me is really a film about somebody who is a relatively successful nerd, right? This film is about just a regular girl.
Yeah.
And then I look at Breakfast Club, and Breakfast Club is clearly from the perspective of socially successful students in high school.
Breakfast Club?
Oh, yeah.
Well, except for, there's stoner guy.
Well, there's a couple, but you know, but he's a socially successful stoner. He speaks his mind. He takes control.
Of the room. He's kind of an artistic stoner.
He's good looking. He doesn't have any, like, he's incredibly good looking, right?
Yeah.
So it's like everybody in that room, even like the Ally Sheedy's in that? So even the character that's supposed to be gross is like a model.
Yeah.
Right.
What? Yeah. The weird girl in the corner is making like a
dandruff,
knockout.
making like dandruff, pictures, like, you know, art with her hair. But she's like, she's like a model and an actress. I guess you get, who is it? Is Seth Green in that movie?
No. I know the nerdy guy.
Michael Thomas.
Yes.
What's his Michael's name? Sean Michael Thomas?
Something like that.
I can't remember his name. He's also
so bad with names today.
I know.
Just
we're
look
at
people.
Look at, there's a Wikipedia. I'm not it.
Yeah, we don't have time for that.
We like to say
no script here.
We don't like to quote any actual sources. We would prefer.
It just sounds so lazy.
We like to say things like, I heard somewhere and I read something one time. And that's okay. You can say that about the podcast too.
You can totally.
One time I heard these guys say. And you could even, like, we don't care. You can misquote us just like I did Molly Ringwald.
Absolutely.
I heard on this Jewish podcast, and that's fine. We don't mind that. That's okay. You know, that's okay.
Yes. So I know what you're saying. So there's something about the polish of Lady Bird, of John Hughes, that actually makes it feel more of like a performance, or even Saoirse Ronan.
Step removed, and it's also, to me, like one level of adolescent development higher than it claims to be.
Oh, interesting.
So if you look at Breakfast Club, what you have is a bunch of folks who are already established in high school. Like, they have established identities, and they're making the choice. Well, they're getting forced to be together, even though they already have established identities. And then they make a choice to have human connection. That's college. Right? Am I right?
Yeah.
And then the Lady Bird film is really like, I already know what I want.
Yeah, she's not nice.
I know who I am. I know what I want. I'm not qualified for it, but I'm going to go after it anyway.
That's a really good point.
And yeah, and then the only people in your way are like mom and dad, and you know. So you know, from a Lady Bird standpoint, like that's more of a college film too. So I look at these things and I see that, and with John Hughes films in particular, I know high schoolers loved those films at the time. But they're not, because they're not really portraying actual high schoolers. They're portraying what high schoolers wish they were. Even a stoner was like, man, I wish I was that stoner. You know?
It's good.
Because he doesn't have any like self-doubt or anxiety. He knows who he's like, you know, he hates the rich kids and he hates the preps and he hates the jocks. And, you know, he likes to get stoned and drink and hang out and be crazy. No self-doubt in that character at all. Versus like an actual high school student, even a high school student would have some level of self-doubt. And they don't have any of that in this.
Yeah. Even the nerdy guy in it has like a backstory and pathos, you know?
Yeah, and he's like firmly establishing who he is. Uh-huh. So like, I see that eighth grade is like, I was youth pastor for 11 years and eighth grade is very accurate. Like I think of the pool party scene in eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And you have some of the kids who are like no body image issues at all. And then the boys don't care at all. Right? It's like that's super accurate.
Yep.
The boys don't care. The girls like terrified to go outside. The adults are totally unaware that that anyone would be terrified to go swimming. They're like, oh, swimming's fun. We'll have some food later. You know? And it captures this like kind of mortification of the poor eighth grade girl.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of eighth grade girls and guys feel that way, you know, like, and then it's like, okay, I'm being exposed and it's in a hostile environment.
And let's give Burnham some credit here. That's a scene where the directing actually really helps. So she basically comes up to the screen door and she's just looking out and we do
homage.
The graduate when he's all in his diving outfit. But we do a slow pullback and we just kind of take in the scene, right? And we see everything you just mentioned in this slow reveal, which really, that works.
That was a great scene. Yeah. And then, the cinematography is pretty good in that. Mm-hmm. And then, I like that. And then the idea of that there is actual danger in middle school. Like, so you get stuff like, what is it, like Diary of a Wimpy Kid and stuff. And it's like, ooh, my teachers are so mean.
Yeah, I don't
You know what I mean? Like that kind of stuff. No, actually middle school can be freaking dangerous.
Right.
People can like try to get you in lots of ways. Yeah. They can wreck you. And so I think this captures that well.
Definitely see that. Yeah. So one thing that Bo Burnham has at his disposal, and it is no small thing, is incredible acting. So the girl who is the lead in eighth grade is out of this world, man. Holy smokes.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She's amazing. Elsie Fisher is incredible in this film. She knocks it out of the park. I mean, she's in every frame. She carries this movie, man. And she's like as real as it gets when it comes to acting, and she's only 15 years old.
Awesome.
15.
Awesome. So, you know that he had to get her to act again because she was doing voice work for a while?
She's in doing voice work for Despicable Me, among other things. Yeah,
so,
go ahead.
So, she had done, like, as a little kid, she had done some work.
Okay.
And then she started becoming a teenager, and she had a lot of acne.
Oh.
And she was like, I don't know if I want to, like, become a teen actors are, like, at this age and stage are not a good thing. So, either her agent or her family or whatever was like, well, let's just do voice work for a while. She's like, all right. But he convinced her to come and do this role.
That's so cool. This role that's like kind of mirroring her real angst, right?
Well, so like this gets right into the Breakfast Club stuff. Yeah, she's got actual acne because she's an actual teenager.
Mm-hmm. It's not makeup.
She filmed this when she's 13 and 14, I think. She's got acne because teenagers have acne. Yep. Teenagers don't look like Ally Sheedy and Molly Ringwald generally, okay? They don't look like Emilio Estevez.
Mm-hmm.
They look like teenagers.
Even Saoirse Ronan had painted on acne. You could totally tell.
And she's
this
older
one was
too.
Authentic.
Yeah, this is legit. And so that's wonderful because it was more real.
Mm-hmm.
It was wonderful.
It was.
And they didn't try to hide it. And they talked about her trying to hide it. And it was just great.
It really was.
But it gets in because there's a vulnerability, like because authentic.
Mm-hmm.
I
identified with her. I mean, she was exactly who I was in eighth grade. Just freaking, at home, I was confident. I owned the world. And then you get to meet a school and I'm head down, terrified.
Really?
Yeah, man. Scary.
It is scary.
Eighth grade is scary. But she's 15. I mean, imagine what this girl's going to be like when she's 30. She's going to be the next Meryl Streep.
Maybe. I don't know.
Who knows? Her IMDb page, you know, they have like they always have quotes on IMDb. It's like these inspirational quotes about their process and like their history.
Yeah.
Her featured quote is, and I quote, "My favorite thing to do is play video games. I love Pokemon. I'm going to get a new Pokemon game soon." It's a feature. She's 15.
She's 15.
Let her be 15. It's great.
Yeah.
I love it. I'm excited to see where she goes from here. Maybe it isn't acting. Maybe. No pressure, but she's got mad talent.
She's really talented. And yeah, she's totally talented. I think she's the reason to see the film, really.
Totally. And she's not the only one. I want to give a shout out to her dad in the film.
Oh, yeah.
Played by Josh Hamilton. He was delightful, right?
Well, he plays what he's supposed to play.
Yeah. is this dad that's perpetually confused by his eighth grader girl who's giving him mixed signals all the time, right?
Yeah.
That car scene, if there's one scene, it's that car scene where she's looking at her phone and then she's like saying, like basically he's just right. driving and she's criticizing like how he looks as he's driving.
Yeah, I love that. Love it's like that. You can't do anything right.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, all right. All right, and he's like trying
don't
to
look so creepy.
He's like trying to accommodate her weird, yeah. her like absolute ludicrous request,
and she's right? like, "That's worse."
Yeah,
I love it. So he was great. His name is Josh Hamilton. You know, he's in a bunch of supporting roles in some really yep. big movies. Manchester by the Sea, Bourne Identity. He's like that.
I didn't
that,
realize he's in Manchester.
Yeah. He's like that guy that just pops up and then you totally forget about him because he's gone.
Because he's one-dimensional. And he is in this film too.
Yeah.
So he's a kind... He's a kind face, mm-hmm. and so that's kind of what he banks on.
For sure.
So it's like this kind, it's hard to play a multi, you know, valent character if you just have like one feel to you. But mm-hmm. I think that's what was needed for the dad in this.
It's right.
like basically just benevolent mm-hmm. in every way and warm.
So Tim, as you're watching Eighth Grade, what stood out to you thematically? Did anything grab you? What or theologically? What stuck
so
out?
So this is... Maybe I always fear that I'm projecting, right? So like that if we see a cross everywhere, then we see a cross everywhere. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. You know, we find what we look for. And I think that the Christians tend to do that more than other folks. I know I do that. So I want to first get into like intent. I don't think there's necessarily intent to do this, but I see the prodigal son.
Mm. Prodigal son. Okay.
Yeah.
In what way?
So the prodigal son has this loving relationship that's right there in the form of the father, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the father will also give the freedom to the prodigal son to do whatever the prodigal son wants to do. Now you get into all the how he asked for his birthright and how it's like he's the same as saying he wished he was dead. But I see that element in our characters where she's like...
In Kayla's father?
Yeah, in mm-hmm. Kayla's father, like where Kayla was like, well, I'd rather just like be scrolling Instagram than like have any relationship with you, even though you're trying really hard to have a relationship with me.
Mm.
Where the real meaning and love and purpose is not you, it's this other world.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I see that she's seeking to have fulfillment, seeking to have adventure, seeking to kind of actualize or differentiate or whatever you want to say in the outside world. And then he's trying to help her do that, but she's part of that process. Like he can't.
Mm-hmm.
She has to experience like all that junk. And so she kind of goes to this far off land in some ways, which is like where she's trying to get all the acceptance in her life from people that are trying to get acceptance from everyone else too.
Right.
And he's there throughout the entire films, just trying basically saying, I'm here. And then he gives her total freedom too. Can I go to the mall? Yeah. You know, can I go to this? Whatever she wants to do. I just want to look at my phone. Okay. And he's like, okay. And, you know, he's trying to have dinner with her. Or can you knock next time? And he's like, well, I did knock.
Right.
But I can knock louder next time. But I don't know what the dialogue
yep.
was.
Yep.
But he's always accommodating and loving and just wants a relationship. And she doesn't want anything to do with him in most of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that there's something prodigal about that behavior. And it's something very eighth grade, too. So the idea that we have inordinate affections where we would think where the things that were far off and that don't care about us, we deeply care for.
Mm.
So we might flip out over the high school friend because we're eighth graders. We got a high school friend and like totally sell our whole self out
yep.
for that thing.
Yep.
Where... the very thing that the very person who gave us life and who was like wanting relationship was so bad. We're just like, oh, screw that. What's the point of that? That's I've been there, done that. This isn't what I want.
And this isn't only relegated to eighth grade. It kind of stays with you the rest of your life. This is the fight, right? On a spiritual level, we're still fighting that eighth grade instinct of pining after the thing that doesn't make us happy when Jesus is right there.
Yeah. So I say there's like prodigal. I'm not saying that this is intentional. This is just,
I know you get so uncomfortable. You just got to own it. I love it. I love it because I think if you look at it that way, you almost give the movie a structure that it doesn't have without it. Like if you put the prodigal son on it, it's almost like that's the structure because it climaxes in that scene around the campfire at the end with her and her dad. Right.
Well, I think it does have I think it does have that structure. I don't know if it's like, you know, if it's how intentional is it, who knows? But I think it has that structure. It does. And the idea of it, she burns the dream. So the idea is like, here's where I'm going to get out. I mean, because her dream is like, I want a boyfriend. I want to be popular. I want to have, you know, that's herself, her future self. So she gives up that future self, burns it. And then she does it with her dad who helps. And she invites him to burn the dream.
Yeah.
So I love that. That's like pure therapy, right? So you're like, oh, no, take all of your aspirations, all the things you want to do. Go out with your father and burn them. Like, that's gospel,
that's beautiful.
Man.
I love
awesome.
It.
Awesome. And then get the freedom to live into a new identity that is more honest.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then you can kind of be recreated through that. So I kind of love that, like that movement, that character development. And then the father is like, oh, I never worried about you. In fact, you gave me, you know, you encouraged me. I didn't feel like I had to encourage you. I was like, whoa.
Dude, if there's one thing you need when you are stuck in your eighth grade crazy body, it's unconditional love. You need a center, right? I needed that. My mom has always been that for me. And you can't appreciate it at the time. Like, I thought she was crazy at the time, right?
Oh, mom.
Yeah, right.
I just want to go roller skating. Why do you got to, like, wait outside?
Right.
Don't drop me off out front.
I still remember when she would drop me off at school and I would hide, like, you know, until she got, like, away into the corner and I could, like, it's so stupid. But it's that.
Like, people are like, oh, he has a mom.
Yeah, he has a mom, right? Exactly. But that unconditional love was my center. When I came home from being bullied all day and feeling like I didn't fit in anywhere, you know, I had that. And as much as I didn't appreciate the time, I needed it. And even beyond that, I had a youth group that was really important to me. I found it in about seventh grade. I remember this one time, it was my birthday, and my youth pastor, who's like the coolest guy at the time, I thought he was the coolest guy, he came with a bunch of college students to bring...
What you think now?
Yeah, yeah, I know.
You're like, weirdo kid.
Probably. But, you know, you're eight in eighth grade, and you look up to these, these college kids. They're buff.
I was
a
youth
and
pastor, that's why I mentioned it.
Yeah, exactly. So they come on my birthday with a cake, and I remember him knocking on the door to my class, and I felt like the coolest kid being able to go out there with these guys.
That's fantastic.
And they brought me a cake.
That's fantastic.
I'll never forget that. Yeah.
That's kind of, you get those, like, in the film, you have the older high school student.
Yes.
And she invites her to the mall with her old, I mean, and she doesn't have to do that.
Yep.
And so you get these glimpses of, like, oh, some older folks who are, like, really...
Mm-hmm. She accepts her instantly for who she is.
Yes.
That older shadow, high schooler shadow.
Right.
Yeah.
In a way, like, I mean, it's incomplete and it's broken and weird, but it's pretty good.
Yeah.
And you know, you think about that and you're like, man, these are so important. Or the cake that showed up to your classroom so that everyone could see. It's like the mall, right? Everyone could see I'm hanging out with older high school students.
Yes.
I am in a car, right? Mm-hmm. I get a ride. Like, that's... Those are so important for a kid. So, yeah. So, I think these are those movies that are about, like, these, you know, states of transition.
Mm-hmm.
They're really powerful. We really latch onto that type of movie because I think we, in some ways, want to go back and change how we did it. And we're like, oh, I wonder how they do it. And, man, I wish I was more like this, or I wish this, or I wish that, or I wish I, even like now as I get older, I'm like, I wish I was more compassionate. I wish I was more thoughtful. And you're like, well, you're like a ninth grader. You're a narcissist.
Yeah, totally.
You only think about yourself in the Pokemon video game or whatever.
Yep,
Pokemon,
yep, yeah. Yep. Yeah. How much do we really grow up? That's another question for another podcast.
No. The late adolescence just keeps going. I'm 40 years old now.
You know, another theme that kind of brought up in a very not condescending or heavy-handed way was how phones have sort of changed a generation. It's a very 2018 portrait of an eighth grader in that, you know, there's all these articles. I mean, you can look them up. I read one on The Atlantic about what phones are doing to the next generation. And, you know, you can actually chart the release of the iPhone with rates like depression, how long they're staying at home with their parents, not getting a driver's license. Like, you can see how it's affected it, and the movie kind of touches on that in a little bit.
How relevant? I mean, like, because our last podcast, guys, was Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Yeah.
So Rogers is worried about television.
Mm-hmm.
How's this? This is going to mess up everybody. this is how the phones are now, right? And we see it and we're like, this is messing up everybody. Like, we have like actual neurological data, right? From some guy that we don't have a source for. So anyway, look it up online. So, or don't, because it would wreck your neurons. So, but like we have this, right?
Yeah.
And we're, this is creating bizarre brainwaves patterns, and this is creating like compulsive behavior, and we are like getting dopamine hits every time we get a, like our pocket goes bzzz.
Yep.
And it's changing how we interact with the world or don't interact with the world.
Yeah.
And so for positive or negative, and I think about Rogers, it's like we have to tell all kids that they're super worthwhile, and this like totally applies.
So Tim, what are your final thoughts on eighth grade? This is your chance, and you got to give a letter grade. Go.
I will say, and I probably said this before, what the Pope said when he watched The Passion of the Christ. He's dead now, but not just Christ, but the Pope watched it, and he said, it is as it was. That's what he said.
Wonderful.
So I feel like eighth grade is a good reflection of how eighth grade is.
Mm.
And I'm not a millennial. I'm not like a eighth grader in this 2018 with a phone that's trying to wreck my life.
Mm-hmm.
But it does seem that way. And I think it has a message about inordinate love, the idea of our love being reordered in order to have true identity. Mm. So I like that. I think it's a good theme. I think it's hard to watch because it's like a horror film at some points, but it does resolve in a beautiful way.
Letter grade?
A-.
A-. So this was a movie with a lot of buzz behind it. It was 98% on Rotten Tomatoes, still is. That's saying 98% of what, 180 critics like this movie, which is really good.
98% of critics are above 50%. Is that what it's
saying? No, 98% of critics are like a B or better is basically what it's saying, which is pretty amazing, right? That's good. But a lot of people went beyond that and gave it perfect grades. Entertainment Weekly was a perfect grade. I think New York Times. So, you know, I went into this, all that to say, very hyped up, thinking this is going to be like the best movie of the year. And I was a little let down.
What's left? I mean, like, if you give this a perfect grade.
Yeah.
What do you do with something that's really
I don't understand
amazing?
It. A perfect grade, no matter how much you like it. I mean, come on.
Like, if you don't come out weeping or like on the ground or like, yes. I remember there's been movies where I'm like, I just got to be alone for a while.
Yeah. Totally.
This is not that film.
No, it is not. So, I mean, look, it's Bo Burnham's first movie. I think it's a bit rougher on the edges. It's hampered a bit by a lack of plot because of that. But it's well-written, masterful performance by Elsie Fisher, worth seeing for that alone, like we said. Overall, I am landing at a solid B for eighth grade. I'm at a B. Maybe we'll upgrade to a B+ if I rewatch it someday, but right now that's where I'm landing at, is a B. And a B isn't bad. It's good, but it's probably not going to make my top 10 list at the end of the year.
So dude, what the... All right, so he texts me his top 10 list right before the film.
Don't start.
You want me to go here?
No, go ahead. It's on the website.
He's giving this a B, and he is Solo on his top 10 website.
Solo's on my top 10 list, and I stand by it. And I thought Solo was one of the best Star Wars films because it had that Star Wars feeling that the modern day ones lack. I think it's a solid movie.
That good old fashioned feeling?
Yeah, the good old fashioned feeling. I gave that a BB+. So I'm not saying that's like an amazing movie. It's so early. It's not going to be on my list in December.
So can I ask you this question? I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Right. This is a better movie than... Yeah, Solo is a better movie than 8th grade.
You saw where I was
Solo
going here.
Solo is a better movie than 8th grade. I'll stand by it. It is. And I'm not a Solo defender. I'm not saying it's the best movie ever. And again, it's not...
John, you know when people lie, their voices get higher? It's like how the FBI does it when they don't have the lie detector machines.
I think Ron Howard is a better director than Bo Burnham because he has more experience. It's not even a fair comparison. But... Yeah,
Ron
but
Howard
again,
got signed onto that late when somebody after somebody walked.
He did. But look, we're talking prematurely, all right? When we're getting to the end of the year in January, when I have my final top 10, Solo will not be on it. But all I'm saying is I don't think 8th grade will be either. Who knows what will be, but that's what I got. It's a B. All right, that is our show for the month. Thank you all so much for listening. And hey, if you have not given us a rating or review on iTunes... This is your chance, man. You can do it right now.
In fact, if you don't do it now, come on, let's be honest. You ain't going to do it.
You ain't going to do it. You have it on your to-do list. I know you do. On your reminders, on your iPhone, you're like, rate and review Cinema Faith. If you could, flip to your podcast app, search for Cinema Faith, scroll down, give us a 5-star rating, and there's a little tab there that says write a review. You can be a 3-word review. Love the show. That's it. That's all it takes. 10
Solo,
seconds.
Really, John? That's a perfect 3-word review.
Unbelievable. He's never going to let me forget about Solo being in my top 10. Do you know, listen, and I want to do this as a plug for the site. I make an ongoing top 10 list that evolves throughout the course of the year. You can follow along. It begins in January and goes all the way through the year. Movies that are on there will not be on there
later. It's like college football a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're like, oh, I wonder what the committee decided this week. And then you're like, oh, Solo's gone all the way
down. Solo's gone. It's chopped off. Exactly.
That's what I'm going to pray for. But see, now the problem now is you've got more resolve to keep it there now.
Yeah, right.
Award season will come up. There'll be like, you know, Meryl Streep will have a film. And
what do you think about this year in film? Do you think it's been a good year so far?
Yeah.
I think it has been too.
So here's how I think, why I think it's been a good year is that we are reviewing excellent independent films in the middle of the freaking summer.
It's August.
Like, how did that, like, but yeah. This is usually like Ant-Man.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We're in that territory where you're kind of like, oh,
I didn't even see Ant-Man 2. Forget it.
Yeah, or like The Rock's gonna kill more gorillas. Like that, there's a film like that every year, right?
Rampage, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was another one last year, wasn't there?
Where he's killing Jumanji.
Yeah, he's like killing gorillas in that one too. So he's gonna. So this is that time period where The Rock kills large animals.
Yeah,
and he did. Okay, like, but I think in the spring maybe. But we're like talking about film that has some substance. It's like, yep. and it's consistent. It's coming out over and over again.
Yep.
So I'm excited. This goes in my funding theory that I always talk about, which is I think that the films started getting funding again as the recession has kind of like, you know, we hit the financial crisis of 2008. And I think we're beginning to see the product of people be taking risks on independence again.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah. I'm with you, man. It's been a good year so far. And it's only halfway through. Think about it. You know, we're actually not that far from Oscar season, like a few months away.
I'm excited. The Super Telluride excited. Film Festival that I didn't go to, but it was in town for last year.
One day we're going to go together.
To Telluride.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Sundance. I would be all right. I'd prefer to go to Cannes.
Yeah, well, me too.
We could.
Where is that? It's not like in
French Riviera, I believe.
Oh,
you and I.
That would be so great.
Swimsuits.
Awesome. So we have no idea what we'll be reviewing for you next time. It's a surprise because we don't know. It will not be The Rock taking down a gorilla, but something. We'll find it. It'll be great, and we will be back here for your listening pleasure. Tim, as always, you're the best.
You're the best.
Thanks for doing this with me another month. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you
next time.
Next time.